Since high candy eating season is upon us, I have a question for you. What's the difference between a Snickers bar and a Fiber One chocolate bar? Well, one we see as candy and the other we see as food. Candy's often demonized, even though supposedly it supplies only 10% of the added sugar that ends up in our diets. The fiber bar could have as much sugar, chemicals, and fat as a candy bar, but we judge these two differently. Well, this is the interesting premise behind a new book by Rutgers University Professor Emerita Samira Kawash. It's called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure. Samira, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you have the word panic in your title, pleasure and panic. What are you talking about?
Well, I think the panic first occurred to me as a new mother. My daughter at that time was about 3 years old, and me and all of my mommy friends were beginning to realize that our kids knew about candy, and we needed to decide if we were going to let them eat it. Well, my daughter ate some jelly beans. She really liked them. She wanted to share them with her friend. I took them over to her friend's house. We offered them, and I said to her mother, "Is it okay if your little boy has these jelly beans?" And she said, "Well, I suppose it couldn't harm." And I said, "Harm? Gee, And then the father kind of chimes in and says, "Huh, so you're going to be giving him crack soon, I guess." And I was like, "Wow, crack? I mean, it's just jelly beans, really?" And I thought about it, and I was like, you know, even though it was an extreme reaction and I felt really uncomfortable about the fact that I had brought these jelly beans into the room, it wasn't the first time I'd heard something like that, that you know, especially around young children, that there was something really harmful and dangerous about candy. And candy in a very specific way, because these same mommies who were very worried about their children's access to candy were handing over the juice boxes with no problem at all. And I'm looking at my five jelly beans, and that's a little sugar. And I'm looking at the juice box, and that's a little sugar. And I'm thinking, you know, really, it's not that different. Why is it that those brightly colored, shiny jelly beans seem to speak of something much more complicated and much more potentially dangerous than the same sugar and the same substances that are in a different kind of form that might be related to apples, let's say?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is candy, it was never meant to be any kind of nutritional element. The juice box, well, you could say there's vitamins in there and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I started thinking about is, you know, candy itself has its own story. And where does candy come from? And how does it become something that means these complicated things to us today? And so I started digging around. I'm a researcher. And so I started doing some research. And one of the first things I did was I ran to the dictionary and looked up words for candy and confection in particular. And confectioner, that's, you know, we call a candy maker a confectioner, but it also means someone who makes medicines and poisons. And this was fascinating to think about that connection between medicine and candy. And of course, it was originally, yeah, it's the apothecaries in the pre-modern period who have the secrets of candy making. And most of the first candies were medicinal preparations. So I started researching sort of the emergence of candy from these ancient apothecaries into our own time and discovered that, not coincidentally, the very first candy machine invented in America was invented by someone working in a pharmacy. And he needed to figure out how to make his lozenges more uniform in shape and how to make them more quickly. And so he invented the first candy making machine in America, which unleashed what I call the candy big bang, the revolution in machine-made candies.
When would this have been? Middle 1800s or something
like that? This was in 1847, the first candy machine. And then the Civil War came along and Americans were pretty distracted and not thinking too much about candy and machines for a little while.
Right.
But after
the
Civil War, all sorts of new kinds of industrial technology come into being and transform just about everything, but transform candy in particular, because now what had formerly been a very expensive and very rare treat is now it's suddenly possible to make candy in massive quantities, so that by the 1880s, candy is available all the time everywhere to most Americans living in sort of any reasonable sized city or town.
But there was a period after that, right, where candy actually becomes evil.
Right? Well,
it was like the temperance movement against candy.
Yes. Well, there were two different strands of thinking about what was dangerous about candy in the late 19th century. And one of them came out of a kind of dietary moralism that had been developing throughout the century, an idea that certain kinds of foods were good and godly and other kinds of foods were overstimulating and dangerous to the organism and were evil because they took your body and your health further away from God. And those ideas weren't about candy specifically, but when candy became more widely available, they attached to candy very easily because candy was made of sugar, and sugar was one of those dangerous, overstimulating substances that might drive you to different kinds of frenzies of vice and sinfulness. At the same time, there was the growing worry about whether manufactured foods were safe or harmful, and the concern that manufactured foods were adulterated with more or less dangerous kinds of things, either fillers that were harmless or perhaps more dangerously poisons and toxins that could harm people. And candy, because it was so completely artificial, you know, it's these wild colors and unusual shapes and forms that were never found in nature, it was easy to look at candy and say, hey, that looks like some kind of food that might be very, very dangerous.
Well, to update to today, though, your premise in the book is that small amounts of candy are a very small percentage of the added sugar that we put in our diets, but that we see candy and food as two completely different things. And that today, if you really analyze the two, they're not so different.
I think that there is a notion that there is a line of food on one side and candy on the other, and we should eat food and we shouldn't really eat too much candy. Except when you look at the food, well, at least I wonder. I just saw an ad on TV for a product called some kind of Fiber One caramel bar or something like that. And the picture looks like a candy bar. It's, you know, chocolate and oozing caramel and nuts and all kinds of yummy, delicious candy things. And then the tagline is something like, you don't have to worry, it's not a candy bar. And I think that urge to have food that looks and tastes and has all the pleasures of candy, but somehow is still going to be qualified as food because it has some amount of fiber or because it has added vitamins or something like that. I think that that kind of merging of processed food and manufactured food and different forms of candy seems to lay the groundwork for some very confused ideas about eating. And I think what I would like to practice in my life and what I'd like to teach my daughter is to let candy be candy, to look at candy and say, that's candy, that's a treat, but you know what? That granola bar is also candy and that fruit snack is also candy. So when you're thinking about having candy, have some candy. And when you want to have food, have food. Have the real fruit, not the fruit snack, if you will.
Interesting take. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Samira Kawash is a Rutgers University professor emerita, creator of CandyProfessional.com, and confesses to a love-hate relationship with the sweet stuff. Well, try this recipe for buttermints from Little Bit Sweets. It's on the website, splendidtable.org.